This is the Wealthability Show with Tom Wheelwright. Way more money, way less taxes.
Every business owner is going to exit their business at some time. So today we're going to discover what makes a business irresistible to buyer. What is it that makes a business valuable? And how do you set yourself up long before you ever exit? How do you set yourself up to exit profitably and to exit well? It's not just profitably, but it's also exiting well. And today we have a specialist, an expert in this area, Sharon Heaton. And Sharon wrote the book, Liftoff, 12 Things to Know Before Selling Your Business. I would argue that you need to know it years and years before you sell your business, not right before you sell your business. And Sharon, it is absolutely a delight to have a fellow advocate for small business on our show today. Welcome, Sharon.
Thank you very much. It's truly a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, thank you. And would you give us just 30 seconds of your background and why you got interested in this topic particularly?
Certainly. I don't want anybody to hate me for this, but I am a recovering attorney. And as an attorney, I worked with companies that were publicly traded at the top part of the market. And it was very intellectually challenging, but emotionally unsatisfying. It was basically moving money from one large corporation's pocket to another. As my career went on, I ultimately found the founder owner, the person who sits at their kitchen table and comes up with an idea and turns that idea into money. And they hire other people, and societies get created because of these smaller companies. These are the people that I felt were not being served appropriately. So when I started SB Liftoff, I really wanted us to focus on what could we do for these founder owners who succeeded. That is, most people don't create a company, and those who create a company don't succeed. And those who succeed could keep it going for 5 years. The people who keep it going and have been profitable for year after year, they've done something special. And they need to be treated with a great deal of respect because they are the backbone of the U.S. economy. I think some people have said, including you, Tom, that it's the backbone of the economy of the world. Couldn't agree more. So my focus was trying to provide practical, useful, actionable information for this group of people so that they could get the best liftoff that they wanted.
I love that. So let's start right into this, since we're both fans of the small business, the entrepreneur. What makes, if you can, what makes a business valuable? Because a lot of business owners, and I'll predicate this with, a lot of business owners own their job. They just own a job. I'll give you a simple example. A carpet cleaner that has a carpet cleaning business makes $60,000 a year. They're the only employee of the business. To me, that person owns their job, and they may have some value in a list, but they really have not built a business. So what is it that makes a business valuable?
You're incredibly right on target there. And it can happen with bigger companies as well. Mm-hmm. One of the chapters in the book is my company transferable? Will somebody want it? And the first thing that I look at is exactly what you were just talking about. Do you, as the business owner, have a company or do you have a job with staff helping you do that job? I was talking to one business owner. He had a food distribution company with about $18 million of revenue. I was very interested in trying to sell it. The margins looked okay. And as I sat in his office talking to him, different employees kept on coming in the room and asking him questions. Questions like, the sink is backed up. What should we do? Mary didn't come into work today. How should we handle that? We've gotten feedback from this client. What should we do? And after sitting there for about an hour, I said, you don't have a company. You have a job with staff helping you do that, making that company work. A question that I'll often ask a business owner is, if, God forbid, you were to walk out into the parking lot tomorrow and get struck by lightning, what happens to your company the next day? If that business owner goes white and says, oh my God, the company can't function without me, yeah, then again, you've got a job. You don't have a company. So that's kind of the first gating item. If you're going to transfer your company and hope to have the liftoff that we'd like you to have, that buyer needs to be convinced that if they put money into your pocket, that the company will continue to exist after you're gone. And no buyer is ever going to believe that you will work just as hard for them as you did for yourself when you owned that company. So the first thing is having owners who are not as important. It's kind of counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. Owners will often beat their chest about how important they are to their company. And I try and explain that the more important you are, the less valuable your company is.
Okay, so that's one thing that makes it valuable. What else? What are some other indicia of a company that has value that somebody else could step into that company?
Sellers need to understand that buyers don't want to step into their problems. That what buyers are looking for is an opportunity. So sellers have to secure their company so that the buyer can step in and use it as a further. That means things like, where's the revenue coming from? Is there any kind of recurring revenue? Maybe there's not recurring revenue, but there's repeat customers. That's fine as well. What is the level of predictability of the revenue? Is it 8 million 1 year, 30 million another, 17 million another? That's going to be a really hard company to sell. If, however, it has been, you know, reasonably consistent, preferably growing, then that's going to give real reassurance to that buyer. The buyer really doesn't know as much about the company as the seller. The buyer is going to do all sorts of due diligence. Part of the due diligence they're going to do is, does the seller have access to the information about their own company? If they don't, that's a warning signal. So the first issue is, how important is the seller? And related to that is, how strong is the secondary management team? Is there a team of people who can keep this company operating? Sometimes I've had business owners turn to me and say, well, whoever the buyer is just going to have to do all the things that I do. And I say, wait a minute, you're working 90 hours a week and you're doing 15 different jobs. No buyer is going to step into that process. You need to fix that so you've got a company. Predictability of revenue, a strong management team outside the seller, decent margins, an understanding of what the future holds for your company and your industry. All of these things have an impact.
I'll share a personal example. So a few years ago, my company Wealthability, we reached Inc. 5000 status, and actually pretty high up, above the 2000 mark. So we were doing really well. So all of a sudden, all the private equity people come out of the woodwork, right? I mean, they're just like, I want to talk to you. I have a conversation with them, and these are the questions they ask. They go, okay, so what they seem to say is, we want to buy an annuity. That's what they want to buy. They want to buy predictable cash flow. And is the cash flow recurring? That was the theme. It actually changed our business model to a franchise model. So we actually went to a franchise in part because of this whole, you know, that recurring revenue stream, because what we were doing is we were creating revenue once, and it was big revenue, but it was one-time revenue. And what they all want to see is, okay, come talk to us when you have that recurring revenue. And that was a big thing. Of course, the second thing is, you know, and this is something that I even get from franchisees who are applying to be franchisees is, okay, Tom, what happens when you die? Right? Because I'm fairly well known in my industry, in our industry. And they go, okay, so what happens when you die? Well, fortunately, that book, Tax-Free Wealth, behind me is an artifact that will continue on long after I'm dead. And that's the type of thing that produces recurring revenue, is you actually have those artifacts doing it rather than you doing it. So I think those are important. I think cash flow, all businesses, and I'm going to ask you this, but my philosophy is, all investments are really a function of a multiple of cash flow. Whether it's if you're in the public markets, it's called PE ratio. If you're in real estate, it's a cap rate, but it's all the same thing. It's all about a multiple of cash flow. So obviously the first thing you have to have is cash flow. And it's gotta be cash flow that happens when you're not there. And I love that. If you look at the market now, because it's changed over the last 2 years, what kinds of multiples, if you have a strong business that has recurring money, recurring cash flow. What kind of multiples are you looking at if you're doing a quick and dirty valuation?
Multiples really depend upon a wide variety of factors, starting with the industry that you're in. There are some industries where you're going to be getting a multiple, well, a couple of things. Smaller companies get smaller multiples.
Right.
It's unfair, but it's just true.
Sure.
A company with $2 million of EBITDA is going to be considered more risky than a company that has $8 million of EBITDA. You might lose one client and it really makes a difference. So EBITDA multiples will vary on a lot of different factors. One of them is going to be the industry that you're in and how visible is the revenue flow. In the book, I make reference to comparing two different companies. One, a cardboard box manufacturer, no technology involved. They basically manufacture cardboard boxes and ship them to a variety of different companies who need them. A lot of them are Amazon, of course. That company will get a higher multiple than a high-end law firm.
Right.
That law firm might, in fact, be more profitable in the short term, but people hire those specific lawyers.
Right.
And if those lawyers aren't there, then that firm may no longer be valuable. So it really makes a difference. If you're selling products, it's going to be one set of multiples. If you're selling services, it's going to vary as well.
So,
you selling your own services or somebody else's?
This is perfect. So as an example, because of course I spent my life in the CPA industry, right? In the CPA industry, I mean, the multiple is very clear. A small CPA firm typically is going to sell for 1x gross. That's basically what a plus or minus 10 or 20%, right? But that's, you got a pretty good idea. If you have a $500,000 gross revenue, you're going to sell it for $500,000. That's basically and typically that's a 3 to 4x multiple of EBITDA. Okay. Because the profitability, I mean, this has been around for 100 years. Everybody in the CPA industry knows that's what happens. So one of my questions for you is, how do you increase that multiple? So for example, to me, one of the things we're doing is we're actually creating software so that we have repeatability. So it's not dependent on the service provider at all. It's actually dependent on the system. So can you talk about that, how important systems are to value and marketability?
Systems are incredibly important because they allow scalability. No matter how wonderful you are, Tom, you only have 24 hours in a day and 7 days in a week, which means that if you're selling your time, you're limited as to how much you can do. If, on the other hand, you have technology that can automate a lot of those processes so that, in fact, your time is not 24 hours in a day, but rather you've got other people who can do that work, now you're talking about scale. And that adds a huge value to the company. What I'm seeing, for instance, in the accounting field is that accounting firms are getting more and more out of accounting. And they're working on issues related to compliance and their certifications, outsourced bookkeeping, other kinds of things that maybe this high-end CPA isn't actually needed to do. Another analogy might be dental offices. When I go into my dentist, I see my dentist, but he doesn't clean my teeth. Somebody else does. And he's able to get 5 or 6 people in there to clean other people's teeth. And as a result, he gets that revenue. So figuring out how to make you, the business owner, less important and to have other people do work that's profitable creates that value for a potential buyer.
No, I love that. And what I'm actually seeing, even in the dental industry, which is actually a fairly big industry for us. We love dentists. They have time and they have money. And we need clients to have time and money because we talk a lot about investing, right? And taxes. And so, but what I'm seeing in the dental industry, and I have some friends in this area, Howard Fran of Dentaltown would be most notable. He's probably best known on that, is they're actually now hiring dentists so that they're not the dentist, right? Yes, they may still stay in it like I do. I still have a few clients because I think it's important for me to understand what's going on with the clients. But I spend very little of my time. It's a very small fraction of my time that I spend with actual clients. Most of the time, what I'm doing is developing the systems so that other CPAs can do what I do. That's the whole idea behind the franchise. So I love that, that you've got to have the systems. Now, I want to talk about another aspect of this, which is tangible versus intangible assets. I just got back from a conference. They talked a lot about intellectual property and the intangible assets. And one of the things he mentioned was, is that if you look at the Fortune 500 from 40 years ago versus today, 40 years ago, 80%+ of their value was tangible assets. And now 80%+ of their value is intangible assets. Could you just kind of, so that everybody's on the same page, distinguish between tangible and intangible? And then if you would, then go right into, okay, so what is it that makes the intangible valuable and how do you protect that value?
Okay, let's talk about a specific example, Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola has a formula for making soda and it has a distribution system and all the rest of that. The value of Coca-Cola is based partially on the fact that they sell soda and other products, but very often based upon the fact that it's Coca-Cola and everybody on the globe knows that company. That is an intangible asset. An intangible asset is something that you can't necessarily put your finger on. It's not touchable. However, it might be something like in the Coca-Cola situation, a brand. It might be for Google, their algorithms for how do they, you know, get the search results going. It could be software, it could be processes, it could be procedures. What is important to understand in intangible assets is they need to in some way add to value to the company. People will look at a no-name soda and a Coke and buy a Coke because it's a Coke. However, we often talk to business owners, very often they're engineers or scientists who've spent a huge amount of money getting IP protection for this particular process or that particular asset, but there's no value being generated by that process or IP. It's harder to put value on that. You need to be able to show a buyer why that's valuable. I will say that the intangible assets are far more important, I think, for bigger companies than they are for smaller companies. Hmm. Smaller companies have a bit of a harder time convincing buyers. To me, that's the difference between private equity and venture capital. People use those terms interchangeably, but they're very, very different.
Walk through those, please, because I do think that's important. I always thought it was interesting. I grew up in the Vietnam era. VC meant something different in the Vietnam era. That was the Viet Cong, right? I actually think of VCs the same now. I think a venture capitalist Viet Cong about the same place there in my world. Because I'm going, this is somebody who wants to take over and just crush me. That's what a venture capitalist wants to do. Whereas the private equity is somebody who wants to come in and actually help me. So walk through that.
Okay. So let's talk about the differences between them and the upsides and the downsides to each. Private equity is basically a professional buyer. They're sitting there with capital and they're looking for companies that they think that they can take over and continue to grow. So they're willing to pay you a multiple of your revenue, a multiple of your income, because they are saying, well, we think that we can grow this 3-4 times over the next period of years so that we'll be able to exit at a greater value. That's terrific. They're looking to maximize that company that already exists. And PE is generally only interested in buying companies that are profitable. They're not looking for pre-revenue companies or things like that. A venture capitalist is somebody who comes into a very early stage company. Maybe it's somebody who's just developed a terrific piece of intellectual property, but they have no idea how to market it. They have no idea how to get money out of that intellectual property, or they don't have the skills, they don't have the team. A venture capitalist will come in and say, okay, thank you very much for what you've done. We want to invest in your company. We're going to take a fairly significant percentage of the ownership. You'll probably still have some, but we're going to try and bring this out. So the people who initially invested in Facebook or Google or whatever, they were venture capitalists. And the assumption for venture capitalists is that some percentage of their deals, a high percentage, will end up failing, that they're going to buy something, try and make it work. But the one or two or three that do work, they will make up for all of those losses. Private equity wants every deal to be successful. So there's a different risk tolerance to them and a different kind of buyer. So if you're a seller, please understand that private equity and venture capital are very different, and you're probably going to be attractive to one of those, not both.
Well, and I actually look at them quite different in that I see venture capital is somebody, that's who you go to when you need capital to grow. And you're, rather than an exit, that is more a growth strategy, whereas private equity is more of an exit strategy.
Private equity has really changed over the last 10 years. First of all, private equity has found the founder owner. It used to be that private equity was only interested in doing deals that were $100 million, $200 million, $3 billion, whatever. Now, they understand that founder owners have really created something special, but they might be subject matter experts, and that company can be improved over time. There's lots of different types of private equity, and some of them want to buy 100% of the company and just take it. Many of them would like to have the founder owner stay in the company for a period of time to continue to grow it, to get past whatever barriers are there. So they're interested in funding the growth as well. But that growth is probably going to be more linear, where in venture capital, they're really looking for geometric growth.
Got it. So one of the challenges I think every small business owner has is that the business is not just a moneymaker. The business is actually a child. I mean, truly. I mean, even when I sold my CPA firm, it was hard to do it. It was very hard to do it because I cared so much about the clients. I'm going, are these people still going to take care of them? Are they going to do a good job, et cetera? And actually, I've been pleasantly surprised by how well they've done. I was not expecting, I actually thought they'd be out of business in a couple of years. And they've actually thrived being the owners as opposed to being, and this was a private sale. You see a lot of private equity deals that 3 years later, and I've got clients that this has happened to, they sold their business to private equity. They drove it into the ground because what makes a small business succeed sometimes doesn't work as it gets much bigger. So how do you deal with that? And how do you help owners deal with the emotional side? Because there's actually a big emotional component to selling.
There's a huge emotional component. And in response to your earlier question, I said, read chapter one. Chapter one is really about the push-pull between the brain and the heart. And there really is a battle going on for the seller. The seller is often afraid of many different things. The fear involved in selling the company. And part of the reason for the book is to try and lower that fear factor. Fear that they're selling at the wrong time. Fear that they're not getting enough money. Fear that the company is not going to succeed. All sorts of fears. Then there's also loss of identity. Business Yep. owners go to the country club and put a little thing on their chest saying, I'm Joe Blow, and I am the CEO of XYZ company. That's terrific. What are you after you've sold? And the answer to that goes back to where we started, which is you are one of the very few people who are able to start a company, make it profitable, hire employees, and make a contribution to our society. You have done that, and your transfer, your liftoff to your next adventure in life is not so much your exit. Right. I hate the term exit because so many of the people who are selling are baby boomers. And you might as well talk to them about bringing a coffin into the middle of the room and saying, lie down in it. Let's see if this fits you. That's not what this is about. This is about there are stages in your life. And there's a stage of your life where you own your company. Mm-hmm. And there's a stage in your life when you don't. And dealing with that loss of identity and who am I if I'm not this title with this job, you know, is very, very important. So there's a lot of emotions going on. And one of the things that we believe is that empathy is a superpower. And in fact, using your terminology, we think that empathy leads to wealthability because empathy allows the seller to think like the buyer and understand what's important to the buyer, and the buyer to think like the seller. Could you imagine a negotiation if you had perfect clarity as to what was going on the other party's side? Empathy won't give you perfect clarity, but it'll certainly get you a heck of a lot closer. And that's how you get a stable deal that's good for all the parties, but particularly the seller.
I like that. I like the idea of it's a liftoff to another part of your life, and it may be a new business venture. I always joke with people that the term retirement actually literally means to take out of service. And who wants to be taken out of service? And when entrepreneurs sell their business, if they really do go into retirement, they're on the golf course, and who are they with? They're with a bunch of corporate executives. They're not with other entrepreneurs. They're sitting on the golf course, golfing with corporate executives. Well, no entrepreneur wants to spend their life with the corporate executives. That is not who we want to be with. We want to be with other entrepreneurs. And so really what you have to look at is, okay, what am I selling into? Right. And I actually think that's an important part of from an emotional standpoint. So when we sold our CPA firm, we sold into now the next level, which was actually providing services to more CPA firms. And right. That's what we did. Right. And now we've actually moved into yet another level, which is the franchise level. And then there's going to be another level after that. So, you know, to me, the entrepreneurs, if you look at people who live a long time, almost without exception, they are working into their 90s. Very few people are done. I mean, you look at whether it's Charlie Munger, right? Or almost 100 when he passed away, but he was working till his last breath, right? I mean, these people are natural. That's so much a part of them. And so I do think that's an important part of the equation when you're looking at exit is, okay, what's next? Because it can't be, honestly, I think for a true entrepreneur, hobbies is not a good next. I think it's got to be something that's meaningful to them, not something that, and where they get to serve other people. Because as you and I know, what's great about the small business is we're all about our customers. We actually have a term, we call it clients first. It is about the clients. The CPAs are great. They're second. The clients are number one. And I think that's something that small business gets that big business loses frequently, and maybe even most of the time, which is why we actually are, you know, big proponents of small CPA firms, not big CPA firms, for that same reason, right? So let's wrap this up. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I could go another, you know, 3 hours with you, which is awesome because that's not always the case in a podcast interview. But what I would like to know is, can you just kind of summarize maybe what are two or three things that a business owner could do now, even if they're not planning to exit for 10 or 15 years?
The best time to start planning your exit is yesterday. The second best time is today. This is thinking about transferring your company is not something that you should be thinking about in the 6 months before you do it, but rather how you structure your company generally. We urge people to work on it 3 years, 5 years, 7 years before they're ready to go. In fact, the types of things you need to do to your company to make it ready for sale make it a stronger company. So why don't you want to own a company that's a stronger company during the time that you own it? As you said, what will make it irresistible to a buyer is that it's irresistible because it's profitable, it's stable, it's been growing, it understands who its customers are, it has some level of a moat around it. Those are all things that you can and should be working on. The first thing to do is where we talked about before, making the owner less important. I've had owners say to me, oh yes, everybody does everything in the company, but I control the customer relations. Well, that's not good. Right. Take the time to start introducing other people in your company so that they have those customer relationships. Buyers are going to be very nervous about really relying upon you. Now, it depends upon what kind of transaction you want to do. If you're looking to take some growth capital from PE, then maybe that's okay, but it's not going to be as valuable. One of the ironic things is what we call the owner's conundrum. The owner's conundrum is, when things are going bad at your company and you've lost a client and revenue's going down and things are, you're just ready to be out. That is exactly the wrong time to sell your company. The conundrum is when things are going really well and you've just landed new clients and your employees are terrific, and that's when you want to go to market, the time that you're least interested in selling because you're having fun. But you've got to be having fun recognizes that that means it's a very good platform for a buyer. So getting yourself ready for A, having fun with running your company, and B, the separation that will occur even if there's a transition after the transaction.
I love it. I love it. Again, Sharon Heaton, and the book is Liftoff, 12 Things to Know Before Selling Your Business. And I've got your website at sbliftoff.com. Anywhere else we go for more information about what you're doing, Sharon? Because I think it's fabulous.
We have an excellent website. We also have a very active LinkedIn profile. We do a lot of public speaking and really education. So anybody who wants to talk about where they are in their business, we're happy to talk to you, even if you're years away from selling.
This is awesome. So Sharon, thank you so much. Thanks everybody for listening. Remember that it really selling your business. We're all going to exit sometime. Some of it may be, when we die, but we're all going to exit that business, and we do want there to be value in it. And we want the most valuable value possible. And why not do it today and not put it off till tomorrow? Because what happens is, remember, it's all about making way more money and paying way less tax. And the two things, we could spend a whole nother section here, I think, on the tax aspects of selling your business, which I think I want to do a follow-up. And if you're on, Sharon, I will have you back and actually talk about that stuff, because that's my expertise, but I'd like somebody in that industry doing that. So just remember, and if you're, if you're really interested in making way more money and paying way less tax, be sure to go to wealthability.com and get your free second opinion on your tax return. We'll see y'all next time.
You've been listening to The Wealth Ability Show with Tom Wheelwright. Way more money, way less taxes. To learn more, go to wealthability.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.